It's getting ready for gardens, planting your gardens, watering, taking care of your gardens, special things we might grow in Fairbanks, possibly things we should stay away from, ways that we should be relating to the earth this summer. Our guests tonight are Grant Mateke, who's with the experimental station here at the university, and Glenn Honer, who has a garden of her own, as do I. We'll be passing a bit of expertise and probably a bit of homegrown information to you tonight. Welcome to Home Fires. We'd like to remind you, Home Fires is always a call-in show, and we'd like Fairbanks to participate right along with us tonight as we talk about gardens. Our phone number is 474-5044. 474-5044. Dial that phone if something's of interest, or if we get a little tiresome, dial that phone anyway and liven us up. Grant, tell us a little bit about what you do at the experimental station to start us off, and that'll give us a little context for our discussion tonight.
Well, the thing that we do that's probably of most interest to the listening audience here is that we do a lot of testing of different varieties that grow well in our unique conditions in Fairbanks. Now, our conditions are unique in that we have a short growing season. It's about 90 days. Some years we get lucky and have maybe 100, 110. And then we have very long day lengths through that period. For instance, Chicago has about half of the light that we have during that 90-day period in the summer. Because of these long days, it does some strange things to some plants. Some plants tend to go right to seed instead of producing a usable product that we might be interested in, such as a broccoli head or cauliflower head, or for instance spinach, which tends to go to seed rather rapidly here because of our long days. And there are other crops which may not set fruit because they require a short day to initiate the development of female flowers, which the fruit develop from. So we have a lot of these unique conditions. We have some plants that respond, or varieties rather, that respond very well to our conditions, and this is what gives us the real large cabbages that we can grow over 50 pounds. Last couple years, we've been growing a broccoli that's called Shogun. It's not available yet, but I think it will be available perhaps next year. The producers are just trying to develop enough seed to sell it. Mm-hmm. It develops a head that gets up to about 14 inches in diameter, excuse me, and it weighs 3 to 4 pounds. Now, that's something like 2 to 3 times what your normal broccoli might be.
And it's all tasty.
Oh, yeah, very good.
Oh,
nice,
goodness.
Tender broccoli, yeah. So we do a lot of that kind of thing. We test over 300 varieties of flowers in the summer. I'd like to ask everybody to come out and look at the flower garden. We think it's a real nice show, and you can pick up a lot of nice ideas for your next summer's flower garden looking at some of the varieties we grow.
You bet. I'd just like to second that. I come up every couple of years and bring my folks up when they visit Alaska, and it's just a delight. Lots of color.
And the other thing we do is test a lot of vegetables, and every year we put out a report that's called a summary of vegetable variety trials that gives all the results of that year's testing, and then we have a publication that's put out by the Extension Service called Recommended Variety List for Interior Alaska, and this lists all the varieties that we've grown for 2 or 3 years or more and have been good producers for us. So anybody that's just starting a garden in Fairbanks, I'd recommend they get a hold of one of these, because it's probably something that you'd want to look at. Now, there's probably some varieties that people have grown here for years and years that are their favorites and are not in this list. Of course, they know how they perform, and they like them, so that we don't think this is the only these are the only varieties to grow here, but they are the ones that have performed very well for us over the years.
Sure, and these are available now at Cooperative Extension? Is that
yeah.
Good guess?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, let's start looking at what we should be doing now to start our gardens for this year. Glenn, you talked about planning. Let's talk a little bit about planning your garden. Step one.
Well, I think planning is probably the most important thing you can do right now at this time of year, because in my experience, I've made a lot of mistakes, and I think that having a plan is probably necessary for a successful garden. Mostly because, as Grant mentioned, the growing season is so short, and that's real crucial up here. I think that as far as a plan goes, you need to evaluate the space you have. If you have a garden spot already picked out, you need to just figure out how much room you have and what kind of vegetables you, the people who will be eating out of the garden like. That's
mm-hmm.
And then on how much you can, if you're planning on preserving or putting some away for the winter, freezing or root, putting some in the root cellar or drying some, you have to figure on that too and how much you're going to be growing. So
two major things are the space you're going to have and what you like to eat.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
And good. Right. Mm-hmm. Or and right now we have the farmer's market, so that's another outlet. So
what you'd like
selling,
to sell,
right,
yes.
Right.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. What kinds of things would you be doing beyond a plan now? Seed planting, my guess is, in the house?
Right. You mm-hmm. can start a few things. Right now you could be starting your outside tomatoes and melons and a few flowers. Mm-hmm. And Grant probably knows more.
Yeah, there are several lists. I see we have one here that's put out by one of the local nurseries. I think probably several of the nurseries have a list. And then the Extension Service puts out a list that's based on when we start things. Now, everybody that starts seeds should take careful notes every year and see how things do, because everybody's conditions are different. We grow our things under probably pretty close to ideal conditions in that we have a greenhouse once they get started. We have heating pads underneath the seeds to help them germinate. And so our things probably grow as fast as we can expect them to grow. If you have them in a window in your house or something, they may not grow as fast. If your house is a little bit warm and you're not getting enough light, they may get a little leggy. So these are a lot of things that make the amount of time that it takes for them to develop into something you'd want to put out into your garden vary. So if you note every year when you start things and then, gee, that was too big or that was too small when it went in the garden, then you'll have a good idea of when to start them the next year. So the guidelines are rough guidelines. If you know that you have, for instance, not very much light where you're growing them in your house, then you or cool temperatures, then maybe you want to start things a week earlier or something like mm-hmm. that. So the best thing to do is take careful notes, and then pretty soon you'll become an expert.
Can we take a look at Ideal? For starting from ground zero, we get a box. We put what kinds of dirt in it, and we give it how much light and how much water. Can we just run through that one for a moment?
Sure. Probably the best way to start your seeds is to get one of the commercially prepared mixes that's a mixture of peat and perlite. A mixture of peat and vermiculite.
Mm-hmm.
These are called Jiffy Mix is one label, Ready Earth or Ready Mix is another one. There's a lot of different commercial names. The nice things about these is that they're very light mixes, so that after those seeds germinate and are big enough to transplant, when you remove the seeds, mm-hmm. all the little roots come out because the mix is so light that you don't have a lot of resistance when you're lifting the,
even
picking out the
vermiculite, I think, would work real well.
Yeah, just plain vermiculite seems to work very well. I'd use the fine for starting seeds rather than the coarser vermiculites. But those are good things to start with. And then watering is an art. It's something that you have to practice with. In a greenhouse that produces bedding plants, the man that owns the greenhouse is the waterer. That's the most important job in that house, and it's the hardest job. So that's something that no one can really tell you how to do. You have to
be able to look at the plant.
Yeah, you have to be able to look at the plants and look at your soil and tell when they're going to start needing water. One of the things that you can use as a guideline is that you'd like your plants or your medium that they're in to dry down so that they're getting plenty of air as well as moisture in the soil. So ideally, you want to water so that about 10% of the water that you add runs through, and then let it dry down to just before things start to need water, just before they start to wilt. Now, that's kind of the critical judgment right in there, and that's where the judgment comes. But in that instance, then you have most of the time you have enough water there for your plants to be growing full speed ahead and enough air for the roots to be respiring.
And your first clue that you're not watering well enough, just plants that want to lay down instead of stand up.
Yeah, it's what you really need to look for is just a spot when they just start to droop a little bit, and then you need to water.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I know this is up to you, but
I've
heard a lot about you shouldn't let your plants wilt, and I was wondering why is that so critical?
Well, a lot depends on the specific variety. Some things will tolerate a little bit of wilting, other things won't, and just won't recover from it. And you shouldn't let them get to the point where they're really wilted. Now, there's a technical terms for it. There's a permanent wilting point, which means just that. They've wilted and they're not going to come back. And up to that point, then most things will come back. But where that point is varies for different varieties. So usually you can tell by looking that, you know, if they start to droop, if you just look like they're not really standing erect the way they ought to be, then that's the time to get in water. Or maybe you should have been a little bit earlier.
Or yesterday, yeah. Yes. You can't be a weekend gardener when we're germinating here.
It's amazing. Some plants are pretty tough, though, and they'll take a fair amount of abuse. But, of course, you're not going to get your ideal growth that you're shooting for if you do that.
Okay. How much light at this point?
As much as they can get for most everything. Some things that are shade plants later on will like a little bit less light, like begonias or something like that. But for most people that are starting things in their home, there's no way they're going to get too much light. South windows, you'll never get too much light in a south window. We grow things in a greenhouse where there can be getting light from, you know, 360 degrees around, and for all of the day, there's no time when they're being blocked, and that's not too much light for anything.
Okay, so we're creating muscle, if you will, in our plants at this point. We're giving them just about everything we can. Is that?
Well, ideally, you want to do that all the way through till you harvest your crop. You want to give them the ideal conditions so they can grow just as fast as they can. Mm-hmm. And yeah, initially it's more important. And if you want, and of course, you know, a greenhouse has absolutely ideal conditions for growth. There's times when it gets too hot, perhaps, or something like that within a greenhouse. So, you know, there's always going to be some limitations, but you always should be shooting for that ideal that you never reach, of course.
Right. Should a gardener fertilize at this point before plants go outside to the ground?
Yeah, things that you have in your greenhouse for a fairly long period should be fertilized. And that, again, is something that everyone has to develop their own techniques for. The one thing that you should use is use a soluble fertilizer. These are the kinds of fertilizer that you find them locally in all of the outlets that handle plants or handle planting materials. And these are the ones that are either pink or blue dyed, and they dissolve right readily in water. If you use a regular field fertilizer, attempt to use it in your plants that you're growing within a greenhouse situation or starting before you get them in the field, they're liable to get too much fertilizer on them. So the soluble fertilizer is very nice because you usually don't have that problem. And if you do make a mistake, I added too much or something like that, then you can just go back in with some clear water and rinse it through, and that'll mm-hmm. take most of the fertilizer out of there when you've over-fertilized.
And that should be done once every 2 weeks?
People have different schedules, and we generally do it about once a week in our greenhouse. Of course, we have a lot of light there, and we follow the label as far as the concentration to add. Now, you can do a lot of different ways. You can do it with constant watering so that you add fertilizer every time you water, and then you add it very dilute. And usually some of the products will tell you how to do that, what concentrations to mix that at. But yeah, once a week or once every 2 weeks is a pretty good way to do it.
Okay. We should be thinning would probably be the next step, right?
It depends.
In the house?
I think it sort of depends on how you start your seeds. I've found that I usually start, if I want, say, 20 broccoli plants, I'll start, I won't count out 20 seeds, but I'll put a fair amount of broccoli seeds into a styrofoam, or maybe I'll use a yogurt container, as long as it has something that has good drainage. Some small container just for that seed, and I'll start it in there, and then when the seed sprouts and by the time it has its true leaves, I'll transplant it to a more nutrient-rich soil that's also light. And so I don't thin, it will probably go into a styrofoam cup then at that point, and just one plant per container.
Uh-huh.
So I don't thin. at this point, anything.
Oh, I see. See, the people I know who plant early kind of strew the seeds, and then
yeah, you can do it that way. I found it's easier to do it this way. You're not messing around so much.
Are there any thoughts about thinning for those who do that?
Well, of course, that depends on the variety and also how long it's going to be in the container before you plant it out. So in those cases, I would try and follow the seed packet or any of the books that you can find on gardening. There's nothing that we do different here than is done anywhere else, essentially, in those stages. The one thing I'd like to maybe emphasize is that you have to make sure that you do have a good, well-drained soil. If you try and use plain old garden soil, your plants will tend to get waterlogged, because in a garden you have just many feet of dirt below the surface, and that all tends to pull water down through the soil. When you just have a little pot and you only have a few inches, and there's not much pull, not much area for gravity to act on, it's sort of, if you can think of a sponge that's saturated with water, if you lay it flat on its narrow dimension, it'll hold a lot of water. If you
sure.
pick it up, it'll start dripping out. So the flat yeah. sponge is essentially what you're growing things in. So you can waterlog them very easily if you just use a plain soil.
Yeah,
and then the other thing is that you need to use something that's sterile. It's something that we haven't come across yet. And the commercial mixes are all sterile. You can make your own mix. If you do, you might want to try what we generally shoot for is something like 1/3 of our topsoil, 1/3 peat, and maybe 1/3 sand. And then we sterilize it with a steamer. Now, you can sterilize that in your stove. I don't know what the time is. Maybe you know. But
I think you put about 6 to 8 inches in a container, cover it, set your oven at 300, and I think you should put probably put a meat thermometer into the soil and make sure the temperature reaches 160 for a half hour,
yeah.
as long as it doesn't get any higher than that, because it will kill beneficial bacteria.
So it doesn't want to get any higher than that, and the duration should only be about a half an hour? So anyone
I think it would be sterile after that. I've also heard you can pour boiling water through it.
I'm not familiar with that, but you know, if you'd have to keep it hot for a good
true.
Period
yeah.
To do that. But, yeah, that's generally the same regimen that we go through, just with larger quantities. And then, of course, there's a lot of other things that you can use in smaller quantities, like vermiculite and perlite and things like that, to loosen up your soil. So if you don't want to use the peat and the sand and everything else, but we just use such large quantities of soil every year so that we're, you know, mixing it by the truckload and sterilizing it by the truckload. So it's a little different process than otherwise. And then there are a lot of places that have it available in bags, so that if you don't want to go to all that trouble, then you will get a little odor in your house from cooking it in the stove. So if you want to avoid all that, then there's a lot of nice mixes that you can buy right out of a bag and part with a little money and save a little work.
Sure. Well, this is Home Fires, and you can call in tonight and talk to our gardening experts at 474-5044. We've got a caller on the line. You're with us if you'd like to speak with us tonight. Hello.
Hello.
Are you there?
Hello.
Yes, caller. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes, very
okay.
well.
Okay. This is Danya.
Hi, Danya.
Hi. I was looking at my seeds recently, and I came across some cucumber seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice it says 58 days on it. Does that mean, I can't believe that it would mean that if I plant them now, would that mean they'd be ready by June 1st?
No, it I'm trying to think of exactly what they are, but anyway, those kind of limits are not really applicable to our environment. Something like sweet corn, for instance, that you see directly in the ground, says 65 days or 58 days for some of them. Those ones that say 58 days or 65 days, when we plant them through the clear plastic mulch, which will warm our soil so that we can get better germination and faster growth, we get those in about 90 to 100 days. So the 58 days or the 63 days doesn't really apply for our conditions. And I'm not sure on that whether it's those days are from seeding or from germination to harvesting the product, but you really can't depend upon that for our conditions. I wish we could.
What does the experimental station know about creating a really good cucumber? What are the steps you should take?
Well, one of the things with cucumbers and most of the plants in that family, such as the summer squash and the winter squash, is that they don't transplant very well, so that we try and start them in something that they'll stay in. And we actually use something called the Jiffy 7, which is just a little plug of peat that initially comes all squashed down and dehydrated, and you add water to it and it puffs up. Mm-hmm. And we plant perhaps two or three seeds in each one of those. Then when they emerge and start to grow, we'll transplant that little plug into about a 4-inch pot, and they'll stay in that until we put them out into the ground. And then with all of those are what we call warm season crops, and they like warm soil temperatures and warm air temperatures. Well, we usually have warm enough air temperatures, but our soil temperatures, if we don't do something to improve them, stay at about 55 degrees or so. And so we use clear plastic mulch to improve the temperature there, and that helps us get real good cucumbers.
You lay it down over the mound, cut a little hole so your plant can grow up through it?
Right. Well, with the
hold it down.
With the cucumbers, we're using transplants. So we'll lay the plastic out. Usually we put something called Chapin twin wall, which is an irrigation tubing that we can water through, so that we won't have to go around and water each hole. Now, if you have a small garden at home, it's probably just as easy to water each hole, but as you get bigger and bigger, you're probably going to want to look into buying some kind of hose that you can irrigate under your plastic with, so you don't have to go from hole to hole. And then when we're ready to plant out, and usually with cucumbers and other warm season crops like that are not very frost tolerant, well, not at all frost tolerant actually, we'll go through and plant those somewhere around the 1st of June when usually we don't have any frost after that time. Of course, you never can tell. And if we do, then we run out there with all kinds of little contraptions
right.
to cover them up and try and save them.
Pots and pans and bags and everything else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go out with a little bulb cutter that's used for planting various kinds of bulbs, and we'll just cut a hole in the plastic. And one of the tricks that we found helps us is with something that's in a large pot, like a 4-inch pot that's 4 inches across at the top, you need about 2 cuts with one of those bulb cutters, one right next to the other, and then you can get your transplant in its pot just soaking wet so that it's squishy when you take it out of the pot, and you can sort of mold it to the shape of that cutting and put it in there. And we've also found that it seems to help to shade cucumbers and squash and things like that, to shade their stems initially, because if you notice, they have a very succulent little stem that's coming out of the soil surface. So we'll just take that pot and set it on the south side of that plant, and it gives it a little shading for that first day or two until the wind or something, somebody kicks it away.
Right.
So that seems to just give a little bit of protection, and it seems to work for us.
Tanya, are you still there?
Yes.
You have more questions about cucumbers?
No, but about peat pots.
About what?
Peat pots.
Peat pots.
Is it true that you shouldn't use them up here?
I would recommend against it, yeah, because if you plant the peat pot in the soil, it will not degrade very, will not break down very rapidly in our cool soils, and then your roots are sort of constricted to this small little area that you grew them in initially. You can take them off before you start, but usually what's happened is by that time your roots in a greenhouse, which are fairly warm, have grown into that pot so that you're stripping off some of your roots. So I would recommend using some sort of plastic pots or things that you can get around the house, like yogurt containers that you punched a hole in the bottom of, or styrofoam cups or things like that, rather than the peat pots. Now the Jiffy mix, which is just really a plug of peat, doesn't have anything to constrict it. One kind, or the Jiffy 7s rather, and Jiffy 9s, one kind has a little net bag around it. And what we usually do is take that net bag off before the roots can get to it, so you don't have any trouble with that. Now, some people say that net bag retards root growth, and other people say it doesn't. It won't bother them. We take it off just to be sure, I guess.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Talk to you later, Danya. Thanks a lot. Well, when we were talking about germinating, we didn't get to or past hardening off. Maybe we should go back a bit and talk about steps one should take to harden off, to prepare the plant to go in the ground. Has anyone any thoughts in that area?
Well, I think the best way to harden off, from my experience, is just to start about 2 weeks before you want to set your transplants out in the garden. And what you want to do is slowly acclimate your plants from the house environment to the garden environment, which is usually more cold and windy and a little bit drier, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And you can move your plants to the outdoors. First, you would start in the shade for a few hours, and before you do full sun, or a few days, I'd say, before you put them in full sun. And then when you do put them in full sun, put them only in full sun for a few hours, and then gradually increase that amount of time every day until they are in full sun. And then you would also cut down on your watering, so that actually that's hard to say. You don't water them as much, but yet you are watering them more because they're out and drying up a little. They're out in the air and they're drying up quicker. So it may seem as though you're watering them more when actually you're trying to. I find that hard to do too. You're trying to cut down, and yet you feel like you're watering them more often.
But essentially, you're safeguarding the plant so you don't shock its system too much.
Right.
So you want to make it a gradual walk out of doors.
Right.
Gradual
you're trying
cooling
to make it
down,
as,
gradual changing in its
right.
humidity.
Right. Uh-huh. You have to be pretty careful. Some days in May are pretty windy, and I think that you have to take all precautions. I mean, I've often taken my plants just out into the wind and sun, and, you know, that can kill them pretty readily.
Having put so much effort into it, you really don't want to knock them off before
no.
you get them in the ground, do you?
No, you should also keep them in if it is a real windy day and if the temperature is below, I'd say, 45 or so.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our listeners that this is Home Fires. We're talking about gardens tonight. And our phone number, if you'd like to call in and join in the discussion, is 474-5044. That's 474-5044. The subject is gardening. We have Grant Matejke from the Experimental Station and Glenn Hohner, who has a garden of her own, as do I. And we'll be very interested to talk to you and talk to each other more about gardens this evening. Maybe we should talk a bit about getting the outside ready to accept the plants that we're so carefully nurturing at this point. There's two types of gardens I think people might be curious about. One is the one that's not been planted in before, a little raw dirt out in the garden, and what should we do about it to get it ready? And after that, maybe we could move to the garden that's been planted and planted and planted for years and years, and things we could be doing to help that soil be more nurturing. Start with a new one.
Okay, well, with either, I think it's probably a good idea to get a soil sample tested. And the Cooperative Extension Service does that, and what they'll do is tell you what the pH of your soil is, and you may want to use some lime to adjust that, and they'll give you recommendations as to how much you should add to adjust that. And then they'll tell you what the fertility of your garden is. Now, this may be very important to people who want to go completely organic and use manure or something like that in their garden, because every manure has a different fertility to it. It depends on, you know, what the animal's been eating. It depends on how long the manure has aged and how much water has run through it and things like that. So that you, if you're going to use manure, you would probably very much like to get a look and see how much fertility there is in that soil. And then you can adjust what you add. So in any case, you'd want to get a soil test. In the brand new garden, probably a lot of people know as much or more about that than I do. I've opened up a lot of new gardens around my home, and my technique is just to get in there and really rototill things in as much as I can. And I leave as much of the surface stuff there as I can and just till it in. Now, mm-hmm. not large sticks and things like that, because they won't break down very fast. But our soils generally throughout the valley are very silty soils. And anything you can do to add tilth to that soil, to add make it a little more fluffy rather than rock-hard kind of soil that we're used to working with, is a big bonus. So if you have a lot of our areas, especially where I am, there's a lot of birch around and things like that. There's a lot of good organic material in the surface mm-hmm. layer, so I just chop all that stuff up back and forth with a rototiller a lot of times. And I think that's a good way to open a garden.
What I did was, you may tell me this is the wrong thing to do and I'll have to go pick them all out, but when I moved into my house, it was a a very old house, and the insulation was vermiculite and gensolite. And I took it out to put in fiberglass. And when I took it out, I put it all in bags. And last year, I put it all in my garden. So it has gobs and gobs of vermiculite and gensolite sitting out there in it. And it's nice light soil. Now, please, Grant, don't tell me no.
I think that's probably a good thing to do. I don't know, you know, whether there's anything they treat that kind of vermiculite or gensolite with that would be toxic to plants. That would be something that, you know, someone might want to find out. But I think probably you're doing the right thing, because what you're doing is adding some sort of organic material that will fluff your soil up and make it a lot easier to work. Now, we grow in large areas, so we really can't afford to put a lot of things into our soil, although every year we till back in everything that we don't use, so that helps a little bit, but it's really a very small amount added for the amount of silt we have, so that we're essentially growing in what's considered a poor soil, and you can do a good job of growing in that soil, but it just makes it a little bit harder. It's a little harder to water, things like that, so that, you know, the more organic material you can get in our soils, the better off you are.
Well, good. Let's take a break from this conversation and ask our new caller if they have questions or comments tonight. Hello, are you there? Hello, caller, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, I'm talking to you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Good. Join the discussion this evening.
My name is Tim Kennedy.
Hi, Tim.
And I'd like to get some thoughts on harvesting seeds for next year's crop. Do you have some thoughts?
You can do it with some things, and I'm not a real expert on that, but the thing you don't want to do is try and harvest seeds from hybrids, because the seeds will be nothing like what you're expecting. A hybrid is something that's developed from two separate lines, and then those lines are crossed to get that seed, and that seed is the only one that will produce that particular hybrid. And so if you have, say, a hybrid corn and you go collect seed from it, you're not liable to get anything that you'd like very much the next time around. So some things, and I'm not real familiar exactly which ones they are, but some things you can collect seed from, but none of the hybrids if you want to get that hybrid. And I would probably say that collecting seeds from native plants is a good idea. Collecting seeds from some of the flowers might be a good idea. But from the vegetables, most of the vegetables that really do well up here are hybrids. And you really want to have that particular hybrid because it does so much better than some other things. Now, there are still some what we call open pollinated seeds, varieties rather. And those you can collect seed from.
Great.
Have you another thought or question?
That ought to do it.
Okay. Thanks for calling in tonight. For those of you listening, it's 474-5044. This is Home Fires, and the subject is gardening with Grant Mateke and Glenn Hohner. And we were talking about creating good soil, if we can't get to the ideal, good soil for a brand new garden. Had we other thoughts there?
I think that's about all that I can think offhand. Our local peat is a nice source to use for amending your soils, and there's plenty of it about, although I think the cost has gone up, as most other things have. And then there's a lot of people that make compost piles, and that's a good idea. It's a little bit of work, but...
And sand.
Yeah, right, and sand's a good thing to add, too, especially if you're... growing something like carrots, which like a little looser soil. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about adding organic matter is that it tends to hold a lot of water, and it holds nutrients a lot better than other things. Mm-hmm. Sand doesn't hold water, but of course it lets water percolate through your soil better, so that it and it creates air spaces in your soil.
We have another caller. Good evening. This is Home Fires, and you're on the line.
I had a couple of questions for you.
Yes, sir.
First of all, dealing with composting, I was sort of alarmed at the amount of vegetable matter that I use just in the process of everyday living, and I figured that I would somehow try to compost that now for use later. Do you have any guidelines on how to do that? And the second question is about all of the starts that you oftentimes get at places like Fred Meyer or Pan Save. The plants are obviously raised outside. And oftentimes the things aren't labeled, so you don't know what varieties they are. I just wonder if those things are hardy enough to survive and produce up here. Thanks.
Sure. Would you like to stay with us or go back to listening on your radio?
I'll listen on the radio.
Thanks for calling in. Well, the first question is composting in Alaska. How do we do it? How do we do it well? And is it worth it?
I'm going to beg off that. I think I'm really not an expert in that. I haven't done it any more than just have a little pile off the side of my garden that I throw everything in. And after 3 or 4 years' time, I figure that it's broken down quite a bit. And that's probably way too long. And anybody that knows anything about composting will probably say, gee, that guy doesn't know what he's doing. And I don't. So I guess I'll let someone else handle that.
Glenn, have you thought?
I haven't done a lot with composting. I have had compost piles, and the same as Grant, I've let them go for a couple of years and then have used them. But I have chickens, so I feed a lot of my kitchen scraps to my chickens, and I figure they're making the compost for me as they sit out there and scratch around and eat. But I have heard it's possible if you just chop everything up real fine. I mean, a lot of people have very successful compost piles up here, and I imagine grass clippings are one of the more important things you can add to that.
I must say I'm glad the two of you have been piling up your vegetable matter, because that's what I did last year. It's beginning to show now, and I'm thinking, oh, I should have done something with that, but now I know it's all right. Well, we'll put this one out to the listening audience. Who's had best luck with composting or worst luck with composting? What do you recommend, and what do you absolutely not recommend? Call us now at 474-5044. We'd love to hear from you.
Well, they do have one more thing. They have a suggestion. I guess they have something written up about composting down at the Cooperative Extension. I've seen sheets down there, so there is some information.
I also remember something that it sounded very complicated being written in the gardening column of the News Miner last fall, and maybe someone in our listening audience will remember that. I remember reading it twice thinking, oh my, no, I don't think I could do this, and backing off, and that's why there's a pile in the backyard.
There is a woman named Eloise DeWitt that has done quite well with that, and at the Greenhouse and Garden Workshop, which was several weeks ago now, she gave a presentation on how she did her composting. But I wouldn't even care to elaborate on it. I'll leave that to the experts in that. The other thing that you can do that's sort of simple composting is every fall, till your garden. Because if you till it and till everything that you don't use back in, if you do that, then most of that stuff will break down over the winter and add a little bit of organic matter to your garden. Not a lot, but every little bit helps, I think.
And the rototiller blades will churn them enough to cut them into small pieces?
Yeah, it'll pulverize things enough, and then, of course, there's a good amount of time that you can leave it. You know, some things, like corn stalks, are a little bit resistant, so you might want to go over your corn patch 4 or 5 times.
Well, that's good to know. It makes it easy, neat, and clean at the end of the year. Sure. The gentleman's other question was about the starts that we can get at local department stores that he seems to think are grown outside. I would expect they probably are. Any thoughts about those? What do we know?
I would go armed with your recommended vegetable variety list for things like that. Now, the other thing that I think he might have been referring to was often large truckloads of ornamental trees and shrubs will come up. And I'm not going to mention any names, but there were quite a few that one store carried last year that were not hardy here. So that people that went out and saw those bargains and bought them ended up, they'll find out this spring that it was not a bargain.
So it was absolutely lovely, but it froze to death over the winter.
Probably, yeah. So the thing to do there, I think, is to check with Extension Service before you buy, or check with some of your local nurserymen who have been in business for years and years providing those kinds of plants, and they'll know which ones are hardy and which ones aren't. Now, there may be some things that they haven't tested and we haven't tested that are hardy. We are every year trying to order new ornamental trees and shrubs and perennial flowers to see if we can find more things that will grow up here under our conditions. And we always find some things that we didn't really expect to be hardy. So that some of these things may be, but some of the ones that I saw, we have tried and definitely did not survive. So I'd use a little caution with those.
Consumer beware.
Right.
All right. Did we complete talking about reviving old gardens? If you've been using a garden every year, are there ways that you can help it be more helpful?
The basic thing that we do, and we use straight bag fertilizer when we do it. We don't use manure and things like that because, for one thing, we need to have a good information on exactly how much nutrition we put in the soil, and all of these are analyzed. They give three numbers on them. The first one is the nitrogen content, and then phosphorus, and then potassium. And they'll be something like 10, 20, 20, or 8, 32, 16, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
For those fertilizers, we use about 3 to 5 pounds per 100 square feet. So that's a 10 by 10 plot. If you're doing acres, I think we work out to we're somewhere around 1,500 pounds per acre usually for most things that we grow. Mm. So I would recommend fertilizing about that level every year. If you do that, you're probably pretty safe that your soil fertility will not ever get too high. If you like to really pour the fertilizer on, then maybe you should make sure that you get your soil analyzed before you plant the next year.
Should you get it analyzed every year anyway?
It's a good habit. It's a good thing to do, yeah.
Okay. All right. Other thoughts for our gardening this year? We've talked about germinating. We've talked about hardening off, preparing the soil. Is there anything else we should do before we put them in the ground outside?
No, I think we really covered that pretty well. I'd probably like to emphasize that if you're trying to grow some of the warm season crops, and these are things like cucumbers, winter and summer squash, sweet corn for sure, peppers. We grow eggplants every year and get a few. It's a real marginal crop, but it's something, if you like eggplants a lot, it's nice to have a fresh mm-hmm. one or two. We grow artichokes,
artichokes
as an annual. Yeah, we just start the seed in the greenhouse, put it out, and we'll get out of each plant, you get one large terminal artichoke that's about the size of the ones you get in the store, and then you'll get three, maybe four laterals that come up to the side after you've harvested that terminal. And they're awful nice to have. They take up a lot of space, and you could never grow them commercially, but it's a nice thing to have an artichoke every now and again. And but anyway, all of those things we grow through clear plastic mulch, and that's because that clear plastic mulch will raise our soil temperatures. On a very bright sunny day, we can get an increase of soil temperature up to 30 degrees. So that's somewhere going from 55 to 85 degrees. Now, most days we don't get that large an increase. And then, of course, as our plants grow up more and more, especially if it's something like strawberries that we're growing on the ground, they'll start shading that plastic and cut down the amount of heat we get from it. But even so, we find it's a real advantage. Sweet corn, I don't think you could reliably get it here without using clear plastic. With clear plastic, there's about, there's one variety I think that everybody could get reliably every year, probably two varieties, unless we had just some hard summer.
I've always wondered if at that point when the plants start to shade the plastic, if it's all right to take the plastic off and let the soil get more air and water.
Well, I'll be able to answer that at the end of this year because we're getting a whole bunch of new temperature probes and we'll be able to tell exactly how much.
Yeah, I did that last year. It seemed to work just fine.
Yeah.
Seemed like the.
But my tendency, I guess, would be to leave it on
mm-hmm.
just because we've got enough to do in the middle of the gardening season, and I'm not sure, aside from the watering. Which could be a problem. We, of course, have
and the weeds.
The chafe, and yeah, the weeds are a problem, too.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're looking at ways that people can grow these commercially as well as just for the home garden use, then we use herbicide on most of these things. And we try and use herbicides that have a very short life in the soil so that they break down rapidly. And we try and avoid it as much as possible. But for growing under clear plastic, it is kind of a necessary evil if you have 300 foot a row, you know, and we have probably 10 or 12 300 foot rows, and I don't think we could get slaves to do that. It's a lot of weeding, and it's hard under plastic.
Have you any plans for keeping the weeds down, Glenn? Or?
No, last year I did just that. I pulled the plastic off, and when the weeds got too thick, when I couldn't keep up with them, and my harvest seemed to be just as good or better than if I had left the plastic on from years before. So I was pleased with that experiment, and we'll probably try it again.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to remind our listening audience that it's 474-5044. That's our phone number here at Home Fires. The subject is gardens. Call in, 474-5044. Grant, what other kinds of unusual vegetables and plants can we grow here? Artichokes just shocked me. I think it's a wonderful idea.
One of the things that's interesting, and I know a lot of people locally are doing it now, is that we've been growing for a number of years strawberries that we grow as annuals. And what we do there is we put down a layer of plastic on the ground and then two other layers that are buried only at one edge, so that we then have loose plastic on either side, and we put a hoop in that and make a little tent. There's full instructions for doing it in a publication that came out in 80 called Growing Ever-Bearing Strawberries as Annuals in Alaska. That's available at the Extension Service, and I think probably at the experiment station also. They should have a few copies left. Anyway, we found using that technique that we can get yields of up to a pound per square foot strawberries, and the yields come on all season from about early July until the end of August.
That's heat and moisture. That's the reason you're getting so great.
Yeah, we're really forcing these strawberries to grow as fast as they can. We put them in this tent. We leave the tent up until they get a large set of flowers on it, and then we'll start bringing the tent down so that bees can get in and pollinate it. Because, of course, if you don't have pollination, then you'll get a very misshapen strawberries with lots of little seeds that haven't been pollinated all together in a pocket.
Okay, tell me more about this tent. We've got two pieces of plastic out to the side. We put in hoops all the way along our berries, and then we're going to pull the plastic up and clothespin it together
Clothespin it at the top. That's probably the weakest point of the system, because the clothespins tend to blow off in a strong wind and things like that. And we haven't found a better way yet. There are other ways that people use outside. It's actually, I probably should mention, it seems like a lot of work to grow strawberries, but strawberry growers in California use this technique. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that's just done here.
What kind of clothespins they use. We have a caller on the line. This is Home Fires. We're talking about gardens tonight. Are you there? Good evening. Is my caller there?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have a question for your guest.
Yes, sir.
I turned in late. But I was wondering about using sludge from the sewage treatment plant and spreading that on my garden, if there were any harmful effects from that. I'll hang up and listen to his answer.
Thank you. Grant, I gather that's aimed for you.
I'm not an expert on that either, although I do know there was a fellow at the university several years ago that used sludge on some grain crops. I think it was probably barley, but I'm not even sure exactly which one it was. The information that he got, I think, should be available, so you should try calling the experiment station and they can tell you what he found. As I remember, there were no deleterious effects from using the sludge from the sewage treatment plant in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. Some places there are problems if there are a lot of heavy metals that are in the environment there, and we don't seem to have that problem. But I imagine it's possible that some years in the future, as the traffic in the city gets a little heavier, that we might have a problem with lead after a while, because that is something that cars seem to put a bit out of.
Okay. So information on sludge seems to be available.
Yeah, I believe that's available. Okay. I know the study was done anyway.
All right.
That's all I know about it.
We have another caller on the line. This is Home Fires. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I have a bunch of seeds left over for last year. I don't know what size garden I thought I really had, but are they still active enough for me to use this year? And my second question is, what's the best way to stake peas? And I'll hang up and listen.
To stake peas? Okay, thank you very much. I also have a drawer with seeds in it. How are those seeds doing after sitting there for 12 months?
Well, they should be fine after 12 months for most things. I can't remember what the proper answer to that question is. I know there's a number of years when you should start looking out. If you have seeds that are 2 or 3 years old, you may want to do just a little germination test on them to see how many germinate, and then you can seed a little heavier than you normally would. Of course, if you're doing transplants, then it's really no problem to seed pretty heavy anyway, and then you're going to be transplanting them out. Just makes it a little harder if there's a lot of plants real close to each other when you do that.
Right. But you'd know within a couple of days anyway, right?
Oh, you could even sprout them in a wet paper towel to see what their germination
right.
was. You'd really see it that way.
Okay. All right. And our next question was about staking peas. Glenn, have you any thoughts? How did you stake your peas last year?
Well, I do it different every year. Some years I don't stake them at all, and I just pull them off the ground and pull the pods right off. But uh-huh. I think that I will try a wire fencing this year with probably 6x6 inch squares on it and see how that works. And
okay.
Sometimes I've used chicken wire and planted my peas in a circle and put the chicken wire, made a circle
around the circle of plantings.
Yeah, uh-huh. And that has worked real well.
Sure.
But it's always something that's a lot of trouble, and I'd like to find an easy way to do it. So I think I'll try fencing.
A fellow down the street from me, see, this is how I learned to garden, is I walk up and down the street and see what looks like it's working. A fellow down the street from me has what looks to be a freestanding fence. It's cyclone wire, that heavy mm-hmm. wire with a wide mesh, and my memory says it's held up with, now how do we do this visually on the radio? I'm holding my hands up here, folks. My memory is that it's long, like pieces of plumbing pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Metal,
yeah,
sure.
And driven into the ground. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but he's got them so they've got. I'll get this, so that they screw into one another, oh. And then he's got elbows. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's two standing up vertically, two short elbows, and then a horizontal one, mm-hmm. And his cyclone fencing is all attached to that. Mm-hmm. And boy, it's pretty too. Mm-hmm. Nice peas, and it's really pretty. So. We have another caller on the line. This is Home Fires. The subject is gardening or cyclone fences, if you got stuck with me there. Are you there?
Hello.
Good evening. This is
Home
Fires.
Hi, I just wanted to reiterate about the caller that called in before about the sewage sludge, using that as a fertilizer.
Oh, good.
And I would say that the heavy metals are definitely a good problem to work with, because those can often come from chemical refineries. Which or any kind of process which would have a metal in it as a waste, so that you should definitely check out the sewage waste for metal content before using it in a garden.
Is there a way that you know to do that? I don't know a great deal about sludge.
So that is definitely a problem, and in mm-hmm. Fairbanks it may not be such a problem because there isn't many chemical industries here,
mm-hmm.
But in other cities that is a big problem.
I believe the study that was done, and I have never read the report, although I did sit in on a seminar about it, and I believe that at that time heavy metals were not a problem here. That was several years ago, and things could possibly have changed. I know the person that did the study did have the sludge analyzed for those heavy metals, because everybody knows that it can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I think at present we're probably pretty safe, but... it's something that should be looked into before it's used.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make sure that was noticed. And as a general practice, I think it's probably not a good idea in gardens. But there have also been experiments with fertilizing tree stands for firewood yields. But other than that, I guess it's, I don't know, as long as it's tested, then one knows what the problems are.
Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night now. The phone number here at Home Fires is 474-5044. We're talking gardens. A couple of calls ago, we were talking about strawberries, and we had them in tubes. After a while, we were able to take some of our clothespins off to let in a bit of air and let the bees in. And your thoughts beyond that, Grant? Or
well, what we do, I should probably get back to the beginning, because I don't know if I emphasized this or not, but we... so far we've found two varieties that have been pretty successful. One is Quinault, and it's a very nice eating berry, but it's a little bit soft. Another one's, and it gives us the best yields. Another one's called Hecker. It's a little firmer berry, so you can store it a little bit longer. It may be better for preserving, things like that. But its yields are not as high, and of course, flavor is a matter of opinion, but mm-hmm. some of us think it's not quite as flavorful as the Quinaults. Anyway, they're ordered and put in every year. The expense is not that great. The yield is pretty high with it. And I know a lot of people do this in their homes, because the perennial berries that are available up here are good, tasty berries, but the yield's not that high. And those are all June-bearing berries, which mean they only have fruit for a limited period of time in the summer, whereas these ever-bearers will bear for a long period of time. Now, because of our day lengths, we need to have a particular kind of ever-bearing berry here, and it's called a day-neutral mm-hmm. ever-bearer, which means that the day length doesn't really affect its flowering. We're a little bit limited in the numbers that we can try. We've grown Quinault successfully. The other varieties, Hecker. There's another one we just tested last year called Tillicum, and we didn't have enough of those to really get a good feeling for how well they do. They were a very nice, tasty berry, though. They didn't yield as well. And there's several others we're trying this year. So we'll continually try and update this information. Once we have these in the ground and they start to bear fruit, then we start fertilizing them pretty heavily. We use a soluble fertilizer, and we usually put it on about once a week.
Hmm.
And what we're really doing is pushing these berries for a maximum yield. And we've tried some experiments to see if we could get them to last over the winter, and we've had a few survive. The ones that survive yield a lot later than the ones we plant out new every year, and they don't yield as much. We did find that we got good survival when we cut off all the flowers. If you don't force them to flower and grow a lot of fruit, then they put a lot of energy into their storage system in the roots and come back fine. But what have you got? You got no berries. So
no berries,
essentially,
pretty plants.
They're annuals.
Okay. This is Home Fires. We have another caller on the line. Are you there? Good evening, caller. This is Home
Hello?
Fires. Hi.
Yes, okay. I wasn't sure if I was on or not. I still sound like I'm on hold.
No, that's you.
I was... What? Okay. There isn't any sound coming through the phone.
Can you hear me? Hello, hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Okay, now I think I can.
Oh, good. We can hear you just fine.
Okay, I'm going to have to listen to you on the radio then, because you're not coming through the phone at all.
Oh, okay.
I was calling in about the comments on the sewer sludge.
Good.
This is Ann Roberts, and I've written a book on gardening in Alaska, which is at the printers right now. And for the book, I did some research on this, and I thought I'd just let you know what I found out.
Oh, please do.